Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Write Stream Tuesday on the Write Stream Radio Network. This is your host, Daria Ann, and I'm so glad you're joining me today. Just want to do a few programming notes before I get to two excellent guests today on this week's program. The Write Stream Radio Network has three wonderful hosts. Well, if I may be so humble, I don't know if I'll include myself in that, but certainly my host on Sunday and Monday are phenomenal, and we have Lisa Tarvez, who hosts a show called Just Believe, and that airs every Sunday on the Write Stream Radio Network at 1 p.m. Eastern. And on Mondays, to coincide with Military Monday on Twitter, the Twitter hashtag, author and military historian John Gresham hosts Military Monday, and that is also at 1 p.m. Eastern. I guess since we're all on the East Coast of the United States, for some reason we'd like to air at 1 p.m. Eastern, but makes it good for marketing purposes and keeps things consistent. But anyway, this week, if you didn't have a chance to listen to either of their programs, Lisa, who is also she's an intuitive and a metaphysical healer, she interviewed a fascinating guest on the topic of life between lives, and it was very, very interesting. I listened to the archive yesterday. So be sure to check that out. And on Military Monday yesterday, John had two guests on to discuss, I think it's a little-known raid during World War II. It was called the Doolittle Tokyo Raid. And very interesting. If you're a history buff, you'll definitely want to check it out. And really check out John every week on Mondays because he does an excellent show as well with great guests. Very informative. So check that out. Write Stream Radio Network relaunched this March of 2013, and I'm just real excited that we seem to be really taking off, and we really appreciate our listeners, and especially to all of you who will listen in the archives. Thank you so much for your support. So, okay, well, let me get to our two guests today. We have, first up is Claire King, who is a wonderful author that I met, and I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear this. I met her through Twitter. And I was just talking with her prior to going live about how much I just love new technology because it has really given all of us the opportunity to communicate with people all over the world. And it just so happens that Claire will be joining us all the way from Scotland today to discuss her novel, her debut novel, The Night Rainbow, which was published by Bloomsbury Publishers out of the UK, and is about to make its American debut. So I'm real excited that Claire was able to join me today, and we're going to discuss all of that. And so without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and bring her on the line because I'm going to give her the opportunity to tell us about herself, and then we're going to talk about her book and her writing, her career, which is phenomenal, and also about the Twitter chat and the book giveaway that we're going to be doing this Thursday. So without further ado, I welcome author Claire King to WriteStream Tuesday. Hi, Claire.
Hello. Hi, Diane. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I love your accent, by the way, Claire. I love British accents. So nice to hear your voice. So why don't I go ahead, Claire, and let me give you an opportunity to first, let's just start by having you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background, and then we'll go get into talking about the book and publishing and all that good stuff.
Sure. Well, so yes, I'm Claire King. I'm an English novelist. I can call myself that now. I came to certainly publishing novels quite late in life. I'm in my extremely late 30s, shall we say. And before that, I've had a business career. I left it about 10 years ago, certainly left a salaried business 10 years ago, and I packed up things with my then boyfriend, my now husband, and we moved to the south of France. And part of the idea behind that was that I wanted really to focus more on writing. I really did want to become a novelist. And so I started to work for myself and became an independent business person and put some more time into writing. Had a couple of daughters along the way. And as you say, I'm currently on holiday at my mum's house in Scotland, where I'm speaking to you from just before dinner time.
Nice. Well, and thank you I really appreciate the fact that you are on a vacation and taking the time to talk with us about your book and your work today on WriteStream. So thanks for doing that. Claire, now, you know what? I'm listening to you, and it sounds like the first thing that popped into my mind was it sounds like you, first of all, you took a very practical approach because you knew you had this goal to be a writer. And yet, and this is so common, I think, with a lot of writers, you need, it's kind of like that expression, don't quit your day job, where you first kind of, you created that foundation of having a career in the quote-unquote real world, I'll say. And then you actually, it sounds like you started a business and you kept up with that while you were pursuing your dream of writing. Is that how that all went out, played out for you?
Yeah, it's exactly right. In fact, I really do admire people who have the courage when they find the love for writing to attack that straight away and launch themselves into that as a career, if you like, because it's extremely hard to break into. It's not very well paid. And so I think it takes a huge amount of courage to do that. And I certainly, when I left school, didn't have the courage to do that and felt that I needed to at least lay the foundations for a fallback career before I could let myself really take on writing and see if I could go somewhere with it. So that's what I did. And then, as you say, even when I decided to make a break for it and try and make something of writing, I still kept up that backup career. I didn't have any option. I mean, you have to pay for the house and for living. So unless you can make a living out of it straight away, then for most of us, I think you do have to have something else.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Claire, did you always want to be a writer, from a young age? Because your career has been in finance, correct?
My degree is in economics, and my career has been in some finance, some sales and marketing, some strategy consulting. And now what I do is I help businesses to collaborate internally. So to work more effectively when they're tackling their problems. So not strictly finance, but it's followed quite a typical career path in terms of tackling the kind of major nuts of business.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, and I think that's so, it's so important because I find some of the writers, not many, but I'll say that I've interviewed writers who were kind of afraid, not afraid, but maybe a little reticent about the marketing, promoting side of things, you know, sort of like the business side. And I find that it's so important to be able to do both, especially with the way things are with publishing right now. It's as if you really have to be able to wear both hats to be able to promote yourself and be smart about that. I mean, the writing the book is kind of like when you finish the book, your work is really just starting. Do you find that to be the case?
I've been extremely surprised at the amount of, let's say, marketing. I've done marketing as a job. You asked me when I decided I wanted to be a writer. I've always been a writer. I describe myself as a novelist now or an author, but I've always been a writer. And in fact, when I look back on the jobs that I've taken, I've always taken jobs that allowed me to be a storyteller. So, you know, in sales, you're telling a story, and in marketing, you're telling a story, and when you're helping people change, you're telling a story. And I think if you have that inside you, when you've written your novel and you want to talk to people about it, you're still doing the same thing. You're doing what you're passionate about, which is you're telling a story. And you have to bear that in mind, because if you start to try and step out of your storyteller's shoes into some kind of cold calling, emailing, Twitter lunatic, then people will really shut off to you.
No, that is so true, and you're absolutely right about the storytelling aspect. So, you know what, let's talk a little bit now about The Night Rainbow. Now, was that was the first novel you published?
It's the first novel that I've published. It's not the first novel that I've written, which I think is pretty typical for many novelists.
Sure, so how many...
I wrote... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was just going to ask you how many you had written prior.
Yeah, I mean, I started and stopped with a number, but the first one that I fully wrote, I wrote, I guess, about 10 years ago, and it was a novel set in Ukraine, just after the end of the Cold War. And it wasn't bad. I had interest from agents, but I never hooked an agent. And it was in the days, interestingly, before social media. And so at that time I was living in France, but I didn't really have any contact with other writers. I didn't have any networks that I could lean on for advice about how do I go about finding an agent, or how do I improve how I write, you know, tips for novelists, that kind of thing. And I felt really lonely. And eventually I put it in a drawer and stuck it to one side. And it was around the time that I had my first daughter. So I had a kind of a writing hiatus. And when I came back to writing and I started to write The Night Rainbow, the landscape was completely different. There was Twitter and there was blogging, and the internet seemed to have come alive with writers. And, you know, I wrote it in an environment that was much, much more supportive for someone a little bit out in the sticks who didn't have a writing group that I could fall back on.
Right. Yeah, Twitter especially, I think, is phenomenal with the writing networks that I've been able to become a part of as well. It's just been such an asset, I think, to writers. And, of course, it has shaken up the publishing industry. But, you know, before we talk about that, I want to get into The Night Rainbow, because you are launching, the book is launching in the U.S., what, this month, Claire?
Right now. Yeah,
excellent.
It came out last week officially, so it should have made its way into bookstores now. And I can't be in the U.S. for it, and I'm so gutted because I love the U.S. now. I'd just love to be over there celebrating and talking to bookstore owners. But talking to you is, it's kind of like a launch party.
Well, good. Well, hey, if you do make it over here, you have to plan a stop in South Florida so we can meet in person.
Well, my brother lives in South Florida, so...
Oh, excellent. Well, good. Well, and Claire, you know, I was reading, now your book enjoys, you know, I was on Amazon where your book is available for purchase as well, and it has a 5-star rating, which is fantastic. And tell us a little bit, without giving too many spoilers, but tell us a little bit about the book and where you found the inspiration for the story and the characters.
Yeah, so as I said, I live in the south of France. at the moment. And I've been there now for 11 years. And I think what's really interesting as an adult when you move to a new place is that you experience it, certainly for the first few months or the first year or so, completely through fresh eyes. And I think that's a really precious time for a writer, because you're absorbing all the things that are different about that environment and different about the place, and it really can feed your writing. And so when we moved out there, really the seasons made their mark on me, and the heat and the smells and everything about the south of France is so evocative. And you can smell the rosemary in the summer, and you, wherever you go, you know, there are fresh ripe peaches and fresh tomatoes, and in summer the heat is so dry and intense, completely different from London where I was before. So I wanted to start writing a novel that was set in this beautiful environment. And actually the novel that came to me was originally a different story, and it was a story told from the point of view of a woman who was living in this environment. And the idea behind it was how sad or how broken would you have to be in an environment like this where it's just so beautiful and everything smells so good, and to not appreciate it and to be so profoundly sad or unhappy that you can't love it and appreciate it. And it started off as her story. But you know, that's a really miserable point of view to tell a story from. And in fact, This character, this little girl P, who's 5 and a half and she's the daughter, turned up as part of the writing process, and it became really, really clear that this was her story, and that the way that we had to view it was through her point of view, looking at this adult grief and this strange behaviour of her mother, and not understanding it, and making what she could of the situation. So, yeah, it's a novel that's told from the point of view of a 5 and a half year old, and it's narrated completely from her point of view.
Well, now, how difficult was that? Because you're saying you started out, it was from the point of view of an adult, and then kind of, and it's so true with writing. It's sort of like as you get into it, things start to change, and you realize, no, I need to, you know, as you're saying, you know, I need to portray this story through the point of view of a child. But how difficult was it to make that transition as a writer? To write through the eyes of a 5 and a half year old. Okay, everyone. I think Claire dropped out, and thank you, Blog Talk Radio. You know what? She'll be back on here momentarily. She can. But if you have questions, you can call into the show at 347-945-7246. And Claire, if you can hear me, just no worries. Just call back in when you can at 347-945-7246. One thing about internet radio, folks, it teaches you how to improvise. And I know that Blog Talk Radio has been having this past week has been very glitchy with Blog Talk Radio. One of my friends was actually hosting a show, and the entire site crashed in the middle of it, and they had to, you know, eventually dial back in and pick right back up where they started. So it's not unusual. And I'll just look to see Claire here on the line, because I really want to get an answer to that question, because. I don't know. I've never written from the point of view of a child before, and I know there are so many successful children's authors out there, and it's always kind of fascinated me, because it's one thing that I've struggled with myself to write from that perspective. But hopefully Claire will be back on the line to tell us how that went down for her. And in the meantime, I'm going to put a link to her blog in the chat room. Her site, her website is claire-king.com. And I'm going to go ahead and put, I had a link to it there. I'm going to go ahead and put it back in here again and really check it out. And while we're waiting for Claire, I think what I'll do is I will just read a little bit of a synopsis of her book to everyone. And I'm going to put a link to the promo for this show from my blog in the chat room in a second. But The Night Rainbow by Claire King has been described as a quote, unquote, powerful novel about grief and salvation told from the perspective of one little girl with a valiant imagination. And let me see if Claire's, she's not back on the line yet. So let me go back to my other window and continue reading. So this is a synopsis of The Night Rainbow by Claire King, which is now available in the U.S. You can find it on Amazon.com, and it has a 5-star rating. And here's the synopsis. It is summer in the south of France, and P and her little sister Margot spend their days running free, inventing games in the meadow behind their house. But P has worries beyond her 5.5 years. Her father has died in an accident, and her mother has just lost a baby. Maman is English, already isolated in this small foreign village, and in her compounded grief, she has retreated even further. P and Margot stay out of her way and try to make things better, but they can't make her happy again. When P befriends Claude, a man who seems to love the meadow as she does, she wonders if he could be her new papa. But why do the other villagers view Claude with suspicion? And what secrets does his large, empty house hold? Beautifully written, haunting, and full of surprises, The Night Rainbow is a novel about innocence and experience, grief and compassion, and the blessings and perils of imagination. And it sounds phenomenal, and I have not yet had a chance to read it, but I certainly plan to pick up a copy. And I encourage everyone listening to do the same. I don't see Claire back on the switchboard yet. So, I think there's something going on with Blog Talk Radio. She's getting a busy tone. Okay. We're going to try to bring her back on in a second here, folks. I think it's BTR having the problem. We'll try this again. I'll keep talking. I'll keep promoting Claire while she's trying to call in. Claire, I'm so sorry. Like I said, this past week on Blog Talk Radio, so many hosts that I know have had problems. And I know the other day when I logged in here to update an episode for another show, I was having the worst time with the site. It wouldn't open, and then when it opened, it wouldn't save my changes. So I have a feeling there's an issue going on there. So, Claire, don't worry about it. And you know what? We can always reschedule the interview too, but I'm going to keep going until you're able to get back in, because I also want to let people know about the Twitter chat this week. For those of you who don't know, we have the RightStream Radio Network, and we also have the accompanying Twitter chat. And the Twitter chat takes place every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern. That's 11 a.m. Eastern Time U.S. And each week I feature a different author. And Claire has been very gracious to accept my invitation to be our guest this Thursday, which is April 25th. And, of course, we're going to talk about The Night Rainbow and about Claire and her career and how she markets herself and her advice for aspiring authors and even, you know, established authors who maybe want to make better use of social media or who just need some marketing advice. I always like to ask all my authors about that. But Claire's going to be our featured guest for the RightStream Twitter chat Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern. And what we're going to do in celebration of her U.S. launch, we are going to give away, I believe, 2 copies of The Night Rainbow. But the way you become eligible to win one of the copies is, one, you have to join the chat at 11 a.m. Eastern. And you have to stay with the chat until noon, because it runs until noon. It's a full hour. And we will have great conversation. Hopefully you'll learn a lot from Claire and what she has to say. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm definitely going to reschedule her for Blog Talk Radio again. And Claire, if you can hear me, you and I can take care of that no matter what happens, even if you're able to get back on the line, because I feel bad that we're having these technical issues and you're not able to to speak on the air to the audience. So we'll definitely reschedule you. That is not a problem. And in the meantime, I'll keep talking about you and your book and hope that people will stay on the line and listen to my Yankee accent and my telling them about, my impressions of The Night Rainbow. But it sounds like a wonderful story. And as I was saying, as a writer, I find it challenging to write from the perspective of a child. And so I can't wait to talk to Claire about that, because I'm so fascinated by that process and how she was able sort of put herself in that mindset. And I'm sure having your own children really helps with that as well. But the book sounds like it's very poignant and sounds like a tearjerker. And if you want to win a free copy, join us for the RightStream Twitter chat, because we were going to discuss that today. So Now that that's out of the way, when Claire gets back on the line, and hopefully that will be soon, we can continue to talk about her and her book, and knowing that we've already promoted Thursday's WriteStream Twitter chat. So it's something that I really love to do. I love promoting writers. I wish that I had known back in 2008 when I self-published my novel, Water Signs, A Story of Love and Renewal. I wish I had known then what I know now. And when Claire was talking about how the whole life changed after she got, you know, she was kind of out of the writing habit to have her child and was kind of focused on her family and her job. And when she got back into writing, she found that a lot of things had changed. That now we had Twitter and we had Facebook and Blog Talk Radio and all of these new technological tools that have helped writers find networks. And I think that's really powerful. As she was saying, she lives in a very remote area and felt kind of lonely and was sort of disconnected from other writers groups. And having that ability to log on and connect with writers on Twitter, for example, is just invaluable. And I see she says she's back. So, Claire, as soon as I see you here on the switchboard, I don't see you yet. Oh, yes, there she is. Wonderful. Okay, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Claire King is back on the line. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
I'm so sorry about that. Blog Talk Radio sometimes, it has its moments. What can I say?
No problem.
So, Claire, let's continue, because I promoted our Twitter chat on Thursday. But let's continue with, I was asking you before Blog Talk Radio so rudely cut us off, I was asking you about, you know, how you made that transition from writing through the perspective, the point of view of an adult to a child, and how difficult that was.
Yeah, somebody said, and I don't know who to attribute this to, that whenever you're writing a story, it's not the plot that you need to be concerned with, it's the character. And I think that's really true, certainly when you're a novelist, a character will emerge at some point who just seems right. And everything else before that can seem chewy and difficult and just you don't feel it. And then someone will emerge and their voice will emerge and you just know that it's the right one. And for me, certainly with P, that was the case. And this little girl turned up and she had points of view and she was tenacious and she had this beautiful kind of sparkly character. And it was her story. And the voice, it just came. And yes, there was a huge amount of rewriting to be done. But it's joyful. When you get to the part where that character has emerged, then the rewriting, really, it's no trouble at all, because it's just such a joy to have found that person, to have found the voice whose story you need to tell.
Yeah, and it gets you right into that flow. Yeah, and that's when things just kind of evolve kind of naturally, it sounds like. Now, the story itself, Claire, though, sounds very poignant. Can you just share a little bit? I did read the synopsis while we were trying to get you back on the air, but tell us a little bit about the story. And P has a younger sister as well, so tell us a little bit about some of the other characters, too.
Sure. So the situation is that Maman, who is the mother character, is very heavily pregnant. She's living in a farmhouse that belonged to her husband, her French husband, although she's English. And her French husband was recently killed in an accident on the farm. So she's grieving for her husband. She also, before the death of her husband, was pregnant with a different child, and she lost that child. And so, as well as grieving for her husband, she's still grieving for this child. And she's feeling especially protective to the child that she's carrying. It's set in the heat of the summer, so very oppressive heat, and she's in the final stages of her pregnancy. And essentially, she can't do very much of anything at all. And because she's English, in this small, quite parochial little French village, she really doesn't have any contact with the other villagers, and her house is a little bit remote. And so she...
Oh, boy. Okay. We got Claire dropped off again. She'll be back. She'll call back in. But, you know, it sounds like a very powerful story. And, wow, that character certainly has endured a lot of tragedy. And, oh, gosh, it sounds like such a great story. And I'm sorry that we got cut off again, Claire. Keep trying. I don't know if it's an issue with Skype, although I am on Skype myself. And I know, it's frustrating. And so Claire's definitely, we're definitely going to reschedule this interview, and hopefully the connection between Skype and Blog Talk Radio will be better at that point. I'm happy that I'm still on the line at this point. Not really sure. I'm sure it's just a technical snafu. So anyway, you know, when we do the Twitter chat as well on Thursday, I will ask Claire a little bit about the plot so that we can kind of let everybody know what it's all about and her characters. But, you know, it certainly sounds as if these are rich characters that are well thought out. And I do agree with her that it's really the characters that drive the story. That's such a good point. And when you finally do kind of clue into that character that really stands out as the person from whose point of view the story must be told, then things do become very a lot easier and they kind of flow better. So we will chat about that on Twitter on Thursday using hashtag WriteStream. And by the way, it's very easy to participate with that. You just log on to twitter.com. You do have to have a Twitter account, which is free. If you don't have one, it's free and very easy to create one. I happen to use a third-party application called Hootsuite, which makes Twitter a whole lot easier to use. And if you want to check that out, it's hootsuite.com. That's HOOTSUITE.com. Hootsuite is one of many Twitter clients. Now, there's a lot of what they call Twitter clients or third-party applications out there that you can use. There's TweetDeck is another one. There's several of them. I personally like Hootsuite because it's internet-based, and it's free if you just have a basic account, and you can still add quite a few social media platforms to it. And basically, it sets up columns that make Twitter a whole lot easier to use and to understand. And so what you'll do for the WriteStream chat is we just use the hashtag, you know, the pound sign and the word WriteStream all together. That's WriteStream. And as I like to say, we stay in the flow of creativity, and that's where I got the name WriteStream from. So join us on Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, U.S. And so Claire is still, hopefully she's still trying to call back in here. But again, her novel, it's got a 5-star rating on Amazon, and it's available for purchase now. We will be doing a book giveaway with WriteStream on Thursday, but you do have to join the chat at 11 and stay for the full hour. And then there's a website that I use that draws names randomly and kind of enter everybody's, you know, Twitter name, and it pulls out names randomly, so it's very fair. And I believe we're going to draw two winners. And then what you can do is you can contact me through my blog to provide your mailing address. And it's so funny. Claire's just sending me a message. At least for the Twitter chat, we won't have this problem. So funny. The same thought just went through my head. With the Twitter chat, it's all typing, folks. So we won't have to worry about Skype and Blog Talk Radio connections. But if you're concerned about your privacy, and if you are a winner on Thursday of Claire's book, you can contact me through my blog, and I have that set up here, and I'm going to go ahead and put a link to the post in the chat room. And I promise I would never give away anyone's mailing address, but we would need a way to get the book mailed out to you. So I'm going to go ahead and put this in the chat room without any further ado, and you guys can check it out. My blog is dariadigiovanni.com, and there's a contact link on there, and you just fill in your information. And Claire is sending me a message, and she's saying, poor P, she never gets the attention she deserves. So you know what, Claire, on Thursday during the Twitter chat, we're going to talk a lot about P and give P her proper due. And I know Claire is still trying to call in, so we do have about 20 minutes left, so hopefully she'll be able to get back in here. And I apologize. Technology is wonderful, and it also has its downside. And here's Claire again, so let me go ahead and bring her back on the line. Hey there.
Hey. Poor P. She never gets the attention she deserves.
Well, I was just saying we will give her plenty of attention on Thursday, but let's continue on. I don't even remember what I just asked you, but tell us a little bit more about P. And Claire, quickly, too, it sounds like you're the maman character, this poor woman, she's been through so many tragedies. It just sounds like such a poignant, heartbreaking story.
It is. And what I wanted to create with Mammon was someone who at least could be a sympathetic character. She doesn't treat P very well. She does neglect her. And P essentially has to fend for herself. She's out there playing in the meadows, and you know, she has a little sister, Margot, for company. But you know, P's 5.5, Margot is 4. And she, you know, the question is, should they be out there playing in the meadows on their own? Should they be making their own meals? Should they be almost turning the tables and feeling that they have to care for their mother? It's a really tricky situation. And what I wanted to write was a novel in where it's really hard to find someone to blame, because this poor woman, she's, you know, she's had a really tough deal of it. And yes, the children are not being cared for. But these kids are really tenacious, and you know, and we have to feel some sympathy for the mother too.
Absolutely. So does she not, now in the story, the mother doesn't have anyone, it sounds like there's no one else that can help her in terms of other family members or anyone. It sounds like she's kind of isolated in this situation with her two young children and a baby about to be born.
That's right, she is. And in fact, her dead husband's family are trying to get her out of the farmhouse and send her back where she came from, because as far as they're concerned, they never really welcomed her, and they've got other family who would now like to inherit that farmhouse and you know, bring up their own children there. And so she's facing this opposition from the people in the village as well, who haven't accepted her and would much rather that she disappeared.
Oh wow!
So, yeah, it's true. Yeah, I mean, the poor woman, she doesn't have a lot going for her, but I think certainly as an adult, you read the story from the point of view of a child, and you can't help but feel something towards this mother. It's like, can you not just get yourself out of bed and give this child some clean clothes and a drink and some basic food? But
right.
She can't.
Right. So now there's another adult character who's one of the main characters as well. Can you tell us a little bit about him? And it sounds as if he kind of fills a void, maybe, perhaps, with these children in their lives.
That's right. They meet him down in the meadow, and he's a man of an undetermined age, but somewhere around middle age, who befriends them. And they do have this desperate longing for some adult affection and some adult company. And P decides that she could probably turn this man into her father, and he could be the new father of the house. With that kind of that children have.
Sure.
And so she starts trying to make this man the father. She tries to get him to be in contact with the mother, which doesn't go terribly well. Meanwhile, the other villagers have noticed that this man is hanging around with these children down in the meadow, and they don't think that's such a good idea either. And they have reason to suspect his motives. And so everybody is just not very certain of what's happening to these children. They don't have anyone else to look after them, but the rest of the village would rather that it wasn't Claude. And meanwhile, P carries on her blithe little way, trying to solve all of these problems on her own.
So it sounds like there may be a little bit of a sinister aspect with Claude, or at least the implication from the point of view of the other characters, that there may be sort of a nefarious motive involved on his part.
I think what's really peculiar about The Night Rainbow is that every reader will read it differently. And I think what I tried to do with it, and from the reviews it seems to have been successful, is that a reader will bring to it their own sort of preconceived ideas about how children should behave, how parents should behave, what danger looks like, and also their own sort of experiences of childhood and perhaps of parenthood. And it's a novel that really engages the reader's imagination to try and get it on a level with a child's imagination. And yeah, without giving too much away, there's a point in the book for most readers where your imagination will split and you will be able to see things from two points of view. You'll be able to see it from the child's point of view, and you'll be able to see it from the adult's point of view. And for me, sort of hearing the reader's feedback on when that happens, which is different for everybody, is just quite magical.
No, that's
fascinating. But I can't say. can't say too much about it without giving things away. But,
No, we don't want to do that. Yeah, the only things we want to give away are a couple of books on after the Twitter chat on Thursday. But everybody has to be present for the full hour to be eligible. Now, the title, The Night Rainbow, Claire, can you tell us how you conceived of the title, or would that be giving away too much of the story? Because I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's okay. There's a moment in the book when the children are in their bedroom after quite a big and scary storm. And as usual, Maman has been absent and not there to take care of her. And the night rainbow appears. And as I wrote this, I realized that actually the night rainbow stood for so much more than this sort of meteorological phenomenon. It's a metaphor really for in the darkest time when you're looking for something to hold on to, for some kind of hope. It's something that can appear to you, and even though it's kind of intangible, you can see it, and it gives you hope that there's something beyond this darkness where you are. And so The Night Rainbow, as a title, hints at hope.
Oh, that's lovely. It really is.
Yeah, it sounds like a terribly sad book, and it's certainly extremely poignant, but what I wanted to do, in fact, what I want to do in all of my writing is I want to tell stories that are hopeful and that talk about the depth and the strength of the human character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to be the kind of person who writes real tragic books. I think you need to have the darkness so that you can see when the light comes out of it and where it comes from.
Yeah, so true. That is very true. Now, Claire, let's talk a little bit, because we have about 15 minutes left, and I wanted to get into maybe this discussion of the process by which you found a publisher. Now, you went the traditional publishing route with Bloomsbury, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So tell us a little bit about that and how that all played out.
So for the first novel that's now in a drawer, I've gone by this traditional publishing route. And at that time, in fact, you were the etiquette of it was that you were only supposed to approach one agent at a time. But the agents were allowed to take 3 or 4 months to get back to you. You couldn't get into publishing houses except through an agent. And so you were kind of at the mercy of this strange system where, you know, even though you needed to approach an average of 20 or 30 agents before getting a chance of being represented, you know, they could literally, you could only get through 4 or 5 in a year. So it was hugely frustrating. And I was so pleased when I came back to it that the etiquette had changed and you were welcome to send out multiple submissions. And so I think I was quite manic about the preparation of The Night Rainbow. I didn't send it out until I was just absolutely happy with every single last word in the book. And I sent it out to a batch of agents. So in the UK, we use the Writers and Artists Handbook, which is our guidebook for agents who represent UK writers. And in my first batch, I was snapped up by a lady called Annette Green, who just started her own agency. And she put it out in submission to publishers. And a month later, I had representation. So it sounds like it all went very fast, but it's my second experience of going through that system, and certainly the first time was very frustrating, but the second time just seemed quite a breeze, really.
Wow, that's great. And so how long from the time you decided, okay, the book is where I want it to be and I feel confident about, you know, putting it out there, you know, how long from that time to actually having it published and out on the market, would you say?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I submitted it in September and signed up with my agent in October. I signed up with Bloomsbury in December. Bloomsbury are a really great publisher. They're still an independent publisher. So they publish, let's say, a select list, but of course they have Harry Potter. They have the background of that has made them big in terms of can do, but they've kept their team really small. And so they said to me, hey Claire, I really would love to publish The Night Rainbow. However, and this is back at the at the end of 2010. However, our 2012 list is already full. So if you want us to publish and have the time to really publish you correctly and to get the right position in the list to do a good job of it, we can't publish you until 2013. So there I was looking at from signing a contract to being published.
Okay, Claire, are you there? Oh gosh, it's hard to. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can. Okay.
Yeah, so I took the decision to go with that because, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So many people want to find a publisher and can't manage it, and so I did. And it was great when I blogged about it because so many people then came up, those kind of 50% who said, congratulations, this is amazing news, fantastic. And the other half saying, you crazy woman, self-published, 2 years, are you mad? I stuck with the decision and I took the 2 years, to write the next novel, and now the first one's coming out, and I'm really actually grateful that I had that time in between to write, because once you launch a book, all of a sudden there's a whole other chunk of your time that's gone, and time is pretty precious as it is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, then you have to spend all your time talking about it and promoting it. So now your next book, is that a sequel to The Night Rainbow, or is it a completely different book altogether?
Not a sequel. It's a completely different book. It's also set in France. It's set on the Canal de Midi, which is a canal that goes from the Atlantic coast near to Biarritz on the west coast of France, and it passes through the kind of southern segments of France and comes out in the Mediterranean. It's sat on the part near Toulouse, and a man who lives on a houseboat there. And it's, let's say, it's an existential love story.
Ooh.
Not a sequel at all.
I think, Claire, I can't hear you. I hope you're still on the line. That sounds fascinating. Claire, are you there? Okay. I don't know why it's cutting in and out for me. Hopefully our listeners aren't having a problem, but it you're cutting in and out a little bit.
No.
Okay, now you're okay. So it's an existential love story, you said. That was the last thing I heard. So
it's an existential love story, and again, looks at some dark situations and strength of character and the hope through.
Fantastic. And so what is your what's the timeline for the next book to be published and out in the marketplace?
Yeah, that's what my agent and my publisher keep asking me. it's in the kind of eighth draft stage at the moment. I haven't shown it to anybody yet because I'm not happy, and I'm working it through, and I'm working it up. And I'm hoping in a couple of months I'll be ready to show it to my agent and to Bloomsbury. But I'm not there yet. And then hopefully after that it'll be a much quicker time to publication because I'm already on the list. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, for sure. Now, Claire, tell us a little bit about your blog. We talked a little bit, we touched upon the marketing side of things. And I've found with the writers that I've interviewed, whether they are with a traditional publisher or whether they've decided to self-publish, it seems that the amount of work on the marketing side is the same. And I firmly believe that every writer should have a blog, and obviously you do too. But talk to us a little bit about some of the things you do to market your book from the technology side of things, from the social media side of things.
Yeah, I was saying to someone recently that I'm so glad. I mean, I got into my blog and into Twitter because I was a writer and I wanted to network with the writers. Because I think it's extremely for a writer who now is waiting, let's say, for their first book to be out in 3 months, just to pop up on Twitter and say, hi, everybody, so here I am, and I have a book coming out in 3 months. And unless you've built up a network of people. It's really hard. It's like walking into a party with a big sign that says, me, me, me.
Yeah.
So I think yes, writers should definitely go to Twitter and find out who they can talk to, but really in the spirit of learning and listening to other people, as well as obviously sharing their exciting news about their books and so on. And from a blogging point of view, I blogged my journey, as so many writers do, through the editing stage and things I was finding difficult and my worries when I put the night rainbow out on submission. And for me, I've never been able to stick to a routine of saying I will blog twice a week and build up a big blog readership that way, and people will expect something every Thursday and every Sunday. I just don't have the time to do it. So I blog when I've got something that I think is interesting to say. And then I tell people about it on Twitter, and people decide if that's interesting or not for them. I think it's great to be out there and talking about writing on your blog or on Twitter. But essentially, in the end, you have to rely on word of mouth to take it forward, because your mouth is just one in a sea of thousands. And so you need other people to advocate your work for you as well, and to love it and to tell other people that they love it.
Yes, that is so true, Claire. Can you still hear me? Because you're cutting out again a little bit. But
okay.
Okay, she's back. So, Claire, tell us where can we find you? I'm on Twitter and other social media platforms. Anybody that wants to connect with you?
Yeah, so on Twitter, I'm at TheKingWriter, which looks pretty rude when you write it down, and I didn't realize that when I first took out the message.
Oh, my God, you know what? I never thought of that. That is so funny until you just said that. Too funny. Okay, so it's TheKingWriter, at TheKingWriter on Twitter.
TheKingWriter on Twitter. And my webpage is claire-king.com.
Okay, and I put links to that in the chat room, Claire, too, for people, so they can see that. And are you on Facebook as well?
I am on Facebook. So if you search under Claire King, you'll find an author page. If you search under The Night Rainbow, you'll find a book page. It's less lively over on Facebook, I have to say.
That's
more
true.
More lively on Twitter.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. You know, it's so funny because I opened my Facebook and Twitter accounts in the same year at the same time. And back then I thought Facebook was so much better than Twitter. Now I love Twitter and I hardly spend any time on Facebook. I agree with you. I think it's easier to, well, because Twitter's less restricted and it's easier to find and connect with people.
It's more of a conversation. Joy of social media is you're having a conversation. Twitter is definitely where I spend most of my time as a writer.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you're good. Go ahead, Claire.
Except for when I'm writing, obviously, if my publisher's listening in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and that's another, you bring up another excellent point, and I talk about this a lot with when I do WriteStream with other writers, is that, you know, as great as social media is, and it certainly is, and it's such a benefit for writers, you also have to be very disciplined about using it, and not, because you can get so caught up in chatting with people and it's so much fun, and then the next thing you know, like 3 hours has gone by and you haven't done any work on your book. So you have to be very disciplined, I think.
Absolutely. I think things need to be kept real, and certainly for me, they need to be kept separate. And when it's my writing time, everything gets turned off, and I'm right, because I'm so easily distracted.
Yeah, that's a smart idea. I have another author friend, her name is Carla Salvo, and she has one computer that just has it just has Word on it, you know, which is the Microsoft Word, which is what she uses when she writes. And she says, I have this computer without internet access because it keeps me disciplined, because otherwise that's all I would, you know, I would just be so tempted to just chat with people all day long. So.
Yeah. You can get programs now that will, you tell it to go and it will shut your web access off whether you like it or not for an hour or so.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right, well, Claire, we're actually coming down, and I'm going to have to bring you back on again because I'm so sorry for the tech problems we've had today. But I just want to want to thank you, first of all, for joining me. And I'll get in touch about, maybe rescheduling so we can bring you back on, and hopefully during a time where we won't have these technical problems. But again, everyone, Claire will be joining us for the RightStream Twitter chat this Thursday, which takes place at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, U.S. I guess you can do a Google and find out what time that is for you wherever you are, but please join us. And Claire, we'll be doing two book giveaways, is it, on Thursday?
Two books to give away, so I'm really excited about that. Books into the hands of readers. It's going great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm excited about it too. And, just to reassure everyone, we'll keep everybody's privacy. We promise, if you're the winner, you can contact me through my blog to get the mailing address. I'll just get that information to Claire so that she can mail the book out to you, or her publisher can mail the book out to you. And we promise we will respect everyone's privacy and it won't go any further. So I always like to say that, Claire, just to reassure people. But again, I want to thank you for joining me today, and I'll see you on Twitter, I guess.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, and thanks everyone for listening.
Okay, Claire, we'll see you on Thursday for the Twitter chat.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Claire King. Please, if you're on Twitter, follow her at CKingWriter. Join us again for the RightStream Twitter chat on Thursday. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back on the air, I'm going to be joined by my next guest, author, U.S. Marine Corps veteran, and law enforcement officer Mark Minear, who is the author of several murder mystery books. And I know that's going to be a fascinating conversation, so please stay tuned. I will be right back after a short break.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Imagine a world where bullying isn't considered a normal part of childhood.
A world where I'm not afraid to go to school.
To speak out.
To be myself.
A world where I'm not afraid to be caught alone.
Come on, punk. We have the power to stop the bullying.
Speak out.
Speak up.
Educate.
Find out what to look for and how you can make a difference at bullying.org.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get out of school.
To turn on my computer.
Message from walk to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
In 99, we had the big tornado. That closet we were in, that was the only thing left of the house. Red Cross helped us and bought food and clothing for us, and just huge outpouring of love, just going, people care.
When a tornado destroyed Stacy's town, your donations allowed the American Red Cross to be on the ground, giving families help and hope. Please donate today at redcross.org.
The National Osteoporosis Foundation predicts that by 2025, osteoporosis will be responsible for approximately 3 million fractures and $25.3 billion in cost each year. Osteoporosis and low bone mass are estimated to be a major public health threat for almost 44 million U.S. women and men 50 and older. I'm Marjorie McGinn, President and Executive Director of Women in Government, an organization of state policymakers. You're never too old or too young to improve the health of your bones. You could have osteoporosis now or be at risk for it without realizing it. Often, breaking a bone is the first clue that you have osteoporosis. Talk with your health care provider about osteoporosis today. With daily exercise and calcium consumption, you can lower your risk for this disease. To learn more, visit womenin.government.org. That's womenin.government.org.
Funding provided by Novartis Pharmaceuticals.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the Rightstream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense, and global terrorism. Rightstream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts, in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday Rightstream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag Rightstream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the Rightstream Radio Network and the Rightstream Twitter chat.
And we are back, and this is Daria Ann, your host of Rightstream Tuesday, and I'm very excited to see that my second guest is on the line. And but before I bring him on, I want to just give you a little bit of information about him from his bio on his website, and I will put a link to it in the chat room here in just a moment. But my next guest is Mark Manier, and he is a former Marine and a 25-year police veteran who worked as a narcotics agent, a SWAT team member, and a homicide detective. Mark has published 5 novels and numerous articles and is a sought-after speaker and teacher. And as he says here on his site, he's still not sure what he wants to be when he grows up. He's married to the love of his life and has 3 fantastic children. I recently interviewed Mark on CRF Radio with my co-host Steve Rosenblum, and I'm absolutely thrilled and very grateful that he was able to join us today on such short notice. So without further ado, I welcome to Rightstream Tuesday author Mark Manier.
Hey, Doria, how are you?
Hey, Mark, I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm glad we got the chance to talk again so soon.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Me too. Yeah. Me too, and thank you again. I had a cancellation. It was kind of a last-minute thing, and I really appreciate your willingness to join me here on the show on such short notice. It's great. Mark, why don't I go ahead and, I gave you a brief sort of intro, but we have a new audience here. So why don't I give you an opportunity to, first of all, introduce yourself in your own words, and then we'll get into some of your books.
Well, as the bio says, I've been in law enforcement actually over 25 years now. I was in the Marines before that. I'm a born and bred Floridian. I was born up in Brevard County, Florida, if any of you all know where that is, Merritt Island, where the Space Center is and everything. And
beautiful.
Anyway, I was introduced. Yeah, I just started writing roughly about 15 years ago is when I really kind of felt God leading me to write. It was shortly after I had become a Christian and really kind of felt God's tug. I was very creative as a kind of a loud class clown type kid. And but anyway, I just felt God's leading to write down stories. The only problem is I didn't really write well. So if you want to be a writer and you don't write well, that's kind of a problem, you know. So I went back to school. I upgraded my education, studied, I wrote, I rewrote, I looked at it. It looked like a train wreck. I rewrote it again, and I just kept working through. Eventually wrote my first novel, went to a writer's conference, met my agent, shot my first novel, never sold. It was my second novel that actually became my first novel, and ended up selling a proposal for Rolling Thunder, which was my first book to come out. So it was kind of a long process, but I felt God leading me to go that direction, but it took a lot of work to get there. I mean, I really had to upgrade my education and get to the point to learn it's one thing to know how to write grammatically correct, but to write in a entertaining novel-type setting, it's a lot of work.
Oh, absolutely, and that you're certainly a model of persistence, Mark, so congratulations and kudos to you for really, doing what you needed to do to get yourself to that point. That's fantastic, and I think that's a good lesson for people listening who are maybe aspiring to the same thing, and because it's true that, a lot of authors, or if you're an aspiring writer, you can have a great concept, but as you say, if you can't write, and I so agree with you, it's not just about grammar, it's also about cadence, and it's about pacing a story and making readers want to keep turning the pages, and that is something that, as a writer, you really need to learn how to do well.
Yeah, you need to, how to keep the suspense, and I don't mean just like suspense, but how to keep the interest of your reader piqued as you're drawing them into your story, as opposed to, what I call information dump. You put everything on the first three pages, there's really no reason to read the rest of the book, So, I mean, there's a lot of little things that you have to learn that somebody can technically write very well. But if you're going to write novel and stories, you need to really learn how story, engages the reader. And I teach a writer's conference for a number of reasons. One, because of the police aspect, I teach a lot of, from the law enforcement, how do you get law enforcement characters correct and understanding what goes on with cops, why they're kind of warped people in to begin with, and all that. We have fun. But also, when I teach at the conferences, a lot of things I talk about is really you don't want your reader to read the story. You want them to experience the story. And that's the difference between good writing and technical writing. There's a lot to it. And I try to encourage writers also, because I dropped out of high school. I was functionally illiterate when I left school. I have dyslexia and dysgraphia, which are learning disabilities. So I really struggled with the written word my whole life. So I understand what it's like to start from scratch and try to, how do I learn this? How do I make this happen? How do I learn how to make somebody see and feel what I see and feel in the story in my head? So I do kind of understand that, and I try to communicate that when I'm teaching and stuff, and hopefully people get it,
Yeah, gosh, Mark, you're so inspirational. Now, so tell us a little bit about the writing seminars since you brought that up. How often do you teach them, and where can people attend?
Well, because my schedule's a little weird, I'm still in law enforcement, so I have a full-time job. But I try to do probably three or four a year. I teach at the Space Coast Writers Conference, the Florida Christian Writers Conference. I've taught at American Christian Writers Guild, and I've taught at a bunch of different places. On my website, I usually keep it up to date of what I'm doing. I do one or two day seminars, and a lot of it depends on, I guess, where I'm going to be. If I'm teaching just a pure fiction or mystery suspense block or a law enforcement familiarization block. It just totally depends. So I try to do that 3 or 4 times a year, just to again keep me fresh too. Because when you're looking at something and you're trying to teach it, it reminds you and helps me as the writer try to get a little better as well.
Absolutely. What's that expression? It's like we all teach that which we all need to learn, kind of. I think that's absolutely correct. And you know what? I'm going to keep an eye on your blog because I can just drive the 2 hours north and attend one because they sound really great. So, Mark, now your books are all in the you write murder mysteries, correct?
Correct. Yes.
And now, now you're a police officer and also a veteran, a military veteran. So, is that where you draw the inspiration for your novels?
Oh, yeah. I have no lack of after 25 years, I have no lack of experiences to draw from. Have to change a couple of the names to protect the guilty. But other than that, you know, there's a wealth of information there and just a lot of interesting people and situations that I've run across through the years. And sometimes I'll blend into stories where somebody who was even there wouldn't know, you know, but there's just so many interesting ideas that are out there, or like I say, situations. And it's funny, my old partner caught me on one of them. We did an interview with a guy at a jail on a homicide case, and a lot of that interview was almost like it was transcribed that was in the book, you know, and talking to the person, and he recognized it, whereas, you know, a lot of other people may not have. But I do try to draw from experiences and stuff like that and just try to give a reader kind of a sense of what real police work is like as opposed to TV police work and what some people have, the concept they have in their mind, because I like to show with my book, especially since I write in a Christian market, and these, I want to show the impact on the officers involved, the families, and, you know, law enforcement itself is a very, very difficult and taxing job. It's not just a job, it really is your life. And I like trying to show how that just really impacts every area of a character's life as well.
Sure. Now, do you have recurring characters, Mark, in your novels?
My first three are based on a Florida Department of Law Enforcement. It's kind of like the FBI of the state. They're a state law enforcement agency, and I use them. There's reoccurring characters in my first three books from a team that was working cases in Central Florida. And then my second two books, 4 and 5, The Night Watchman and The Corruptible, were of a former homicide detective out of Orlando who had been wounded on the job and ends up becoming a private investigator. So, there's two sets of series there, but yeah, reoccurring characters, yes.
And I'm sure that they must be, these characters obviously must be very well developed because you're basing them on real people who, and I've often wondered about this with police officers. I mean, it must be so difficult, and I want you to speak to this. It must be so difficult to sort of keep your, how do I want to say this? You know, your soul or your faith. When I'm sure you encounter some of the most horrific things that most of us, you know, everyday civilians would never even come across. And so, how do you can you speak to that a little bit and how that also plays into your character development?
Yeah, that's one of the things I want to show. I mean, it's hard. It's, you know, everybody knows police work's hard, but it really can take a toll on you. Even if you have, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm strong in my faith. God's been very good to me. I have a great wife and family and stuff like that, but it's still, there's still cases that keep you up late at night that, you know, that kind of haunt you. I hate to use that word, but it really does. And I try to show that on the characters, too, that nobody walks away from a violent crime unscathed, you know. And I think it was Michael Connelly who best said it, you know, the best detective stories are not on how the detective works on the case, but how the case works on the detective. So, you know, when somebody's reading a story, they want to identify with the character. They want to understand and go with them, as well as, especially like with mysteries. I know mystery readers want to solve the mystery along with the detective, but they also want to see what's happening with him and the character. So all of these things, and unfortunately or fortunately, I have a wealth of experience to draw from as far as how it absolutely can impact you when you see a child, you're working a child homicide, or you're, dealing with families who are experiencing these horrific losses and these kind of things, it absolutely plays on your soul. And again, fortunately, because I'm a Christian and that's who, you know, that's my faith and I understand that, I actually think it does help me quite a bit because, to be honest with you, I have a context for evil. Where I've seen some people who may not have faith or may not really, or they're not sure, maybe more agnostic, really grapple with just understanding of why evil. Why is this so? What is this? What's going on? Where I understand. It doesn't make it always easier, I guess. So, I mean, it's still hard to watch somebody go through a difficult time. But I have a context for evil. I look at it and I understand that this is the world is a big spiritual battle. And that's what's going on here. It may manifest itself physically, but there's good and evil. And that helps me at least cope. I try to inculcate and put that into the characters as well.
That's great. That, you know, that was going to be my next question, Mark. You read my mind about how that spiritual battle, you know, was going to ask you if that plays out.
Well, that's a new trick I picked up then.
Yeah, because as you were speaking and you mentioned that, I thought, oh, I need to ask him if that kind of plays out with your characters and with. So do you present characters who have that same perspective as you do, where they view this as a spiritual battle? And even though it might not always necessarily make it easier to cope with, they at least kind of have a context to sort of try to understand it better.
Yeah. Well, in my first three books, my main characters are Christians, and they have a different perspective. But my second two, I wanted to get a look at horrific circumstances and crimes from the perspective of a non-Christian and be fair about it, and then have the context with a partner who's with him who is a Christian. So he's on the outside looking in. And what it looks like, yes. But so I do try to take that dynamic and give all the points of view, I guess, or at least multiple points of view from a same circumstance from a different prism, you know, because I realize not everybody sees the world as I do. Not everybody shares the faith and all that. But I want to give it a fair prism and see what faith looks like from the outside as well, if that answers your question. So I try not to be just, oh, it's all, you know, Christian John banging and everything's always wonderful and hunky-dory. Life doesn't work that way. Real life is hard, you know, whether you have faith or you don't, you know, the difficult things happen and you have to try to put in some sort of context and deal with all these things going on and move on, whether you have, you know, faith or you don't. So I try to be fair with that and show both points of view and if that makes sense, both worldviews, I guess.
Sure. No, it absolutely does. And what are some of the coping mechanisms that your characters have? I mean, whether they're Christian or whether they're coming from a more agnostic standpoint, what kind of coping mechanisms do they have to really, you know, navigate through some of these horrific crimes that they have to, you know, come into contact with?
Yeah. Well, in my first book, my main character is John Russell, very devout Christian and all this, and leading on the outside a very strong life, but inside still harboring a lot of wounds from his childhood and abuse that he suffered and stuff like that. So even though he could put on the happy face, underneath he was really struggling, and it's the case that he's working of a missing child that brings all of this up to surface in him. And he's trying to work it out with his own family and his life and his unforgiveness and anger that he harbors toward the person who really tried to murder him when he was a child.
Mm.
So, you know, I try to show it on those. And then like my last two books, The Night Watchman and The Corruptible, I have a agnostic, if at best, protagonist, and he's a, like, unfortunately, like many people in law enforcement, he's a chronic alcoholic, really struggling with, you know, trying to put everything, and even though he tries to suppress the feelings he has, and, oh, you know, I'm a tough guy, this doesn't really bother me, well, it does, you know, and so he's really struggling with getting a grip on his drinking as well as, you know, dealing with the case at hand that he's been given.
Right.
So this is an example.
Yeah. No, it sounds fascinating. I got to get a couple of copies of your books because I love mysteries, and I love the fact that these books, the characters sound so rich, you know, in your novels. I also wanted to ask you, and this obviously applies to real life as well. I mean, you talk about how difficult it is from the point of view, you know, of the police officer or the detective, which certainly has to have an effect on their families. Do you explore any of those aspects in your book?
I do. I do, because it does. There's been times, you know, that and it's fine, I've seen it in my own life. You know, I mean, it's actually, and again, I don't try to make it all about Mark, but that's where I draw from. You know,
sure.
As far as there's times when I would have to come home, I'd actually sit in the driveway for a while and try to decompress. Because, you know, during the day, I may have interviewed a pedophile in the morning, went out and worked a suicide case in the afternoon. And then you got to come home. And, you know, my kids didn't know that. They were little. They, you know, they didn't need to
right.
know that, for one thing. And they didn't, you know, I didn't need to be an emotional, mental cripple or go detach and just do all these things. So I would sit in my driveway for a couple minutes sometimes when I got home, just take a deep breath, pray a little bit. It's like, all right, well, you know, the day's done. I'm home. I'd come in, and a lot of times I'd fake it. I'd come in, hey, how you doing? I always give a hug before I left and when I came in. And so I kind of made a plan on how to deal with
sure.
the difficulties of this. And sometimes you just fake it, you know. Yeah, I'm in a lousy mood. I had a horrible day, but you know what? My kids didn't know that. So you come in and laugh and giggle, and in 5 minutes, it's amazing if you're faking it, how you kind of transition into that. But with the characters, though, I know those feelings, so I tried to, I didn't necessarily have them handle it the same way, but I understand the play that it can have. And I've seen friends and colleagues, I've seen what law enforcement can do, and it can really, really wreck you as a person and wreck your health, everything, your marriages. I mean, the divorce rate in police work is roughly double what it is in society, which is difficult enough as it is now. You know,
wow.
They just did a study here in Florida, I think it was last year or the year before. The Sheriff's Florida Sheriff's Association commissioned it. The average life expectancy for a police officer, now this isn't counting murdered on the job or anything like that. The average life expectancy is 11 to 12 years less than the average male. It's roughly about 59 years of age. The average ex-police officer who's gone through a career will pass away at. You know,
oh,
so the
goodness.
Impact on people's lives, I mean, your health, your everything is huge. And I've seen it, again, I've seen it with my own eyes. So I try not, you know, I try to give a fair portrayal and at least let readers who may not be familiar with what really the job does to somebody, I do try to let them into that little world of, you know, this is it. You know, it's not like, you know, hey, you know, I'm done for the day and I just go home. You know, when you're a police officer, you live it 24/7. You know, when I walk outside my door, I'm back at work. People don't understand
right.
that. You know, when I go to Walmart to pick up something, you can bet I'm armed. I'm watching because I've dealt with so many people through my career. I've made life, gotten death threats and all that. And I know every other officer who's out there does. And when you walk out your door, your shield is up and you're looking around. And you're and it, so you can't turn it off after so many years. And it can have a real impact on you emotionally,
mm-hmm.
psychologically, and all these kind of things. And it impacts marriages, relationships with children, and these kind of things. So I'm a big advocate. One, I'm trying to help police officers recognize this. But two, trying to create believable characters within the stories that a reader could appreciate the difficulties, you know, that the job has.
Sure. No, I think that's great. You really put sort of a human face on police officers, because I think all too often in our society, people are so quick, and rightfully so maybe in some cases, but, you know, you see all
yeah.
these stupid shows on TV that show, like, the worst behavior among cops, and people
yeah.
sort of get this negative attitude. But, you know, from the other perspective, and I've often thought of this, like, as I'm driving down the road and I see a cop, you know, maybe he's pulled a car over and he's walking over to the car, and I think to myself, you know, that must be kind of scary for them, because you don't really know who's sitting behind that wheel, what you're going to
yep.
encounter. And I think that people, a lot of people unfortunately lose their appreciation for that.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I never excuse bad behavior for police officers. We should absolutely be above the standard. There's no doubt. I don't excuse it. And there's things you watch, I'll watch on YouTube too, and I'll be like, oh my goodness. There's no defending it, you know, when you see legitimate bad behavior. But sometimes when you see an officer using force to arrest a subject, everybody's like, oh, it's police brutality. It's like, well, you can't really just let him go, and the guy's trying to kill him, so he has to defend himself. So, again, not everything you see is necessarily police bad behavior. But I do try to help educate that. But one of the things I share with it, like a lot of times people's experience with police officers are kind of gruff and nasty, and again, I don't defend it. But I'm saying what I try to teach in my classes, at least some of them, is can you imagine every day from the time you get on your work and you're going in, you're in your patrol car, when you're out there, every call you answer, if you get a call of a domestic, most cops know that 23 to 25% of the guys killed on domestics are ambushed before they ever get there.
Mm.
So you're making your plan to go there. You're making your plan where you're going to park, how you're going to approach the car. You immediately start in the mindset of, I could be ambushed here. To when you go up to the door, to standing on the sides, to doing all these things, every call you go on, you're prepared to do battle. Every single call, and it spikes your adrenaline. When you pull a car over, when you're walking up, you better be prepared to do battle. And you do that on every single call. When you can't, we don't even go to lunch like everybody else goes to lunch. Yeah, I don't know if you recall, probably 3 or 4 years ago now, the four officers who were killed in Lakewood, I believe it was Oregon, when they were just sitting there in the morning having breakfast.
Yes, yes,
you
know, I do remember that. Horrible.
And I have friends. Yeah, so you always have to be watching. I mean, I've heard rumors of all the time. We heard this all the time, how people would spit in our food. And, you know, so it was constantly.
God.
You have to be vigilant everywhere you go. If I, if I got out of my car to go into a 7-Eleven just to get a soda or something, I would have to, because I realized as soon when you get out and you're in uniform and you're in a patrol car, every eye follows you. So you have to scan the inside of the store to make sure you're not walking into a robbery. I had a friend of mine do that. I mean, I've had several. One guy walked right in, and the guy blew past him. Luckily, he didn't shoot him, but he had a gun. He was robbing the store. So, I mean, when you know and you experience all these things, you're constantly on a high alert, which keeps your adrenaline really high. But then you go home, and everything crashes. So what comes up must come down. So you get
sure.
in this cycle of high adrenaline, low adrenaline. It's called hypervigilance, where you're keeping aware. You're watching everybody's hands and belt and stuff when you're walking through a crowd and stuff. I mean, it can be exhausting. But you keep that level up, and that's why it impacts marriages and all these things, because you go home and you're too exhausted. I mean, literally, physically and emotionally, to try to deal with what's going on at home, be a good husband, father, parent. So, I mean, there's things there that people aren't necessarily aware of, the little things. You know, like I say, every part of your job, everything you're doing, you better be prepared for battle right then. Because you're going up to a car, you may have to pull your gun and go right then. So you have to be on your best always. So when somebody pulls you over and they're a little bit grumpy and blah, you know, well, they've probably been through a lot that day. You never know. Again, please do not misunderstand me. Don't ever excuse bad behavior from cops, ever. Because we should be better than everybody else as far as our behavior and our professional conduct and stuff. But just understand that sometimes if he's not the nicest guy or he's got a scowl on his face, it's probably been a rough week. I'm just saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
No,
and I also think, Mark, that, you know, kind of like so many things in life, it's such a small percentage that may behave badly, but yet that's what's promoted on television and in pop culture, you know, and exaggerated really in a sense. So,
sure,
and I'm so glad that you explained all that, because I think that it's really important for people to have an understanding, because, you know, who do they call second that they need protection or they need somebody to come to their rescue? It's the police. So,
I mean, like in Boston this week, when the police officers, when they caught him and they were coming out, and you had SWAT, you had 500,000 cops walking down the street, and everybody was applauding and clapping. I mean, it almost brought me to tears, you know.
Yeah.
Just watching that going, you know, holy cow. Everybody for half a second, everybody there was a real community. You know, the police, the citizens,
right.
And everybody was just appreciative. And it was as horrible as that event was, to watch that, at least lifted me up a little bit going, okay, that was good to see. Everybody appreciated what everyone was doing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Mark, and in real life or in your books, like what is, and you don't have to tell me if you don't want to, but I'm just curious, like what's maybe some of the worst crimes that you've had to deal with? Anything that really like hit you the hardest? What are some of the ones that have hit you really in the gut where you thought, oh my gosh, like, you know, how can anybody fathom this kind of evil?
Yeah, there's been a few. I mean, I think the one of them that impacted me probably one of the hardest is we actually arrested a guy from my own church for abusing his children.
Oh, boy.
And, I mean, this is somebody who sat in our pews, who, you know what I mean, and just, it was so close to home, and it was so horrific. I'm not going to go into any details, but it was so horrific. And, I mean, I've worked a lot of homicides. I've done all that. But this one really, it really impacted me. Just that close to home and all was going on. It was just, for whatever reason, that one really, really set me back. But, you know, and there's been others through the years. I think a lot of times, you know, after a while, the bad part is you really do get callous toward death and other things. I wish it weren't that way. I wish we could always grieve and, you know, every wound like it was a fresh one, but you really can't do that and functionally survive.
Sure.
You know? But there's been a few cases that we've had that have been harder than others, you know. And, you know, especially with children and women or somebody who's totally defenseless, you know, and it's tough. Those are the ones that stick with you for years, you know.
Yeah. Now, are those some of the ones that help you, that give you inspiration and kind of, you know, through your writing sort of give you the ability to deal with better?
No, I don't write about those because they're too graphic.
Oh.
I don't even go there. I put them in the ugly place where they need to be, and then that's about it. Pray about it and move on, you know.
Sure. Okay. Now, in terms of the writing process, Mark, let's talk about that a little bit. So you have how many books out now? You have 6 books that have been published.
Five books. Five novels.
Okay, 5 novels.
Yeah.
And I know they're available on Amazon because I checked out your Amazon page. But how did you – I mean, so you went the traditional publishing route, I assume, and you got an agent and somebody – okay. Now, how was that process? I mean, I understand, you know, you went through the schooling and the writing, you know, to really kind of hone your skills. But in terms of getting an agent and getting your first book published, what was that like?
It was, like I talked about before, it was a lot of work. But I'll tell you what helped. And helped a lot was writers' conferences. And again, it doesn't have to be ones I teach. I'm telling you, writers' conferences where you can sit down with editors and have people evaluate your work and get face time. That is huge. Because, you know, when you try to send a submission to somebody, they don't know who you are. They don't know if you're some, you know, you know, sitting in your mom's basement 40 years old or whatever. Yeah, who knows? You know,
yeah.
They don't know who you are. But when you get time and I'll give you a heads up, most editors and agents, if you'll spend the money and the time, because it does cost, I mean, to go to these things, if you'll do that and you show up and you have a manuscript and you're there and you're ready to learn and you have a humble spirit that you'll listen, they already know you're already ahead of the game because you're a serious writer. Anybody who does, nobody's going to spend money, do that time. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, but few people, I've met a few. Few people actually do all these things and not be willing to listen, grow, and become a better writer. And that's what they're really looking for. Somebody who not only can write well, but can be easy to work with, that, you know, and is willing to become a better writer. I mean, I told my first editor, I said, look, I am so new at this. Anything you think helped me be a better writer, you will not hurt my feelings. Okay? Put notes to the side. Anything you think I should need to know, if I did it, I don't know, so let me know. You know, and so it's been a really good experience, and it grew a lot by doing that. But that's my best piece of advice is go to writers' conferences, get Writer's Digest magazine, and write and write and write and submit. Never be afraid to submit. The worst they can do is tell you it stinks. That's the worst thing that can happen to you. So
right. And it sounds like you also have to be willing to accept constructive criticism. Kind of, you know, and a lot of writers tend to be sensitive, so you sort of have to put that aside and really be willing to take a hard look at your writing and where you can improve, because it's really for your benefit to do that.
Yeah. Well, let me correct you on one thing. Not a lot of writers are sensitive. All writers are sensitive. We're all a bunch of artsy little sensitive, and obviously when we write something, it is an errant script given from God through us that can never be corrected, tweaked, or changed. You know? I say that tongue-in-cheek because it is. It's hard when you've poured your heart and soul in this, and when somebody looks at it and goes, you know, gosh, you really need to work on this, this, and this, it's like they're attacking you personally, but they're not. And that's the thing that everybody's got to get over. Your writing is your writing, and when somebody says it needs to be changed, tweaked, or worked, it is no indictment of you personally or the amount of time or your desire to do these things. You know, it's not an attack. You have to look at it for what it is. They are helping you. When somebody says, you know, you need work here, maybe you should try this, they're trying to help you. Now, you're certainly free to disagree with them. And not every review is absolutely correct. But you have to have that humble spirit to look at them and say, yeah, you know what, I could really do this better. I need to work on dialogue. It really does sound like, you know, computers spitting something out rather than people actually talking. Or something along those lines. You have to have a humble spirit to say, you know, that makes sense. How can I work on it and get better? And, you know, you have your 3-day pity party, you know, you do what you got to do, drink or whatever. And then you get back and you start writing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Mark, what do you – you have an excellent blog, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this too, because I do – sometimes I come across writers who don't really – they don't like to blog, and I just think it's so critical also, you know, to blog about your work. And I find myself it even helps me stay in that flow of creativity. What are your thoughts about blogging and new media in this sort of digital age, this internet age that we're in?
Well, I'm a little behind on new media. I'm trying to catch up. But, you know, there's always advice, well, you need to blog, you need to Twitter, you need to – which I have no problem with. But I've actually started working more on my blog, to be honest with you, simply because I have things I want to say, you know. I mean, I like people to read it, maybe be interested in my books or whatever. But in reality, a lot of what I'm blogging are things that I feel passionate about. Because as a writer, you know, everybody would love to, you know, be James Patterson and sell billions and billions of books and do all that. But in reality, I write because I feel I have something to say. So I have my blog there. I put my opinions out there, and I always try to be respectful to any other opinions or those kind of things. You know, I'm not going to, you know, like I told you, I'm a devout and passionate Christian, so I'm going to share things that I feel are true and accurate, and some people agree, some do not. But in reality, I'm tweaking, I'm really working on my blog simply because I just feel like I have a lot to say with everything going on, and maybe some people like it, or it can start a conversation in other areas. So I don't necessarily blog simply to promote my writing per se, in as much as I feel God's called me to write, so you know what, I'm going to write. I'm going to share things I feel that maybe bless somebody or help somebody, or I'll rant when I'm really angry about something. But either way, you know, it depends on whatever mood I'm in. But I try to make it a good writing and solid writing. You know, so it does help when you're writing every day when you're trying to put something out there, because I do try to edit and re-edit before I put my blog out at 2 in the morning or do something like that. You know, I want to make sure that at least it's, you know, somewhat coherent. But that's really my blog, and that's why I'm going to try to work on the new media and the other things, is because, you know, obviously, and it doesn't, and I don't mean it in an arrogant sense when we feel we have something to say, but in reality, if you're a writer and you're putting your thoughts, ideas, stories, notions, because this story is a worldview you're carrying too. So when you're putting something out there, it's because every writer does believe that they have something to say, and I believe every writer does have something to say. We're all called to do different things, maybe, but, you know, if you feel you're called to write, you absolutely have something to say that other people should hear. So with my blog, that's how I view it. Yeah, if people are interested in my books and all that later, or, you know, I can do that to promote an upcoming book, yeah, sure. But in reality, I'm doing that to connect with people out there and share ideas.
Yeah, and I'm in the same boat with you on that, Mark. I use my blog for a variety of things, not just the promotional. And, yeah, I express my opinion, and I think that's what it's all about. And you know, the great thing about a blog, too, is, like, just as you were saying, not everybody is James Patterson, so it's not like you can pour everything into all these successful books and achieve commercial success at his level. So for me, the blog is also a place where I can write whatever I want and not worry about an editor in the sense of editing my content. You know, I check it to make sure it reads well. But you're free to really write about whatever you want on your blog.
Yeah. And that's, you know, because I write in the market that I do, in the Christian market and stuff like that, I think, amongst other, I belong to a writing group where we all, an online group, where we all kind of know each other, a lot of people in the Christian market. But I'd probably be, and I've heard it discussed in there, to stay away from certain topics on blogs and try to only be positive. And, you know, for the most part, I try to be respectful, but, you know, to be honest with you, if there's subjects I feel like tackling or something going on that I feel needs to be pointed out, I'm going to do it. And if somebody's going to be angry at me and not buy my books or do whatever or say nasty things, well, you know, I really can't do anything about that. I'd much rather be true to who I am as a writer and as a person than sit there worrying about promotional things or who I might offend. Or, you know, again, I try not to be nasty or anything like that, but I am going to put my opinion out there. And, you know, if that hurts somebody's feelings and they don't want to buy my book, well, hey, you know what? Life goes on, you know. The only nice part about being for so long is that my feelings have been totally seared and I don't have much left. So it's like, well, okay, you know, sorry you feel that way. And you move on, you know.
I am so with you on that, and that's exactly how I run my own blog. I think that is so true. Now, Mark, in terms of, you know, one thing I found, and I've only self-published one novel, and gosh, 3 years later, I'm still working on a sequel, but one of the things I found when I was promoting it, and I did really go heavy into social media, especially being on the self-published side, but one of the things I found, and I wanted to get your experience on this, was that people were, as interested in me as the author, if not more, than they were in the actual book. And so do you do a lot of local speaking events, and did you find that's true as well?
I do. I found that's true. And I also know, I knew early on, look, I was a homicide investigator writing detective novels, okay? I knew I had a little bit of a shtick and a platform there, which I felt was good because, again, it opened opportunities. I can go speak. I've done a lot of speaking engagements, and I actually enjoy it. I really, because it's interaction. Either whatever audience I'm there to meet with and discuss, be it a men's church group or a ladies', you know, reading club or whatever, you know, or at these conferences, it's just engaging with the audience and sharing that time together is just great. I enjoy it. And, yeah, so I do a lot of different platform things, but I feel, again, this is what God's called me to do. And some of it is, as I alluded before, is to let people understand what the police culture is like, but at the same time is to carry a message to men or to do whatever. So I hope that answers your question. It's a little convoluted, but I think I got through
it. No, it absolutely does. So do you have any plans? Are you working on any books now?
I'm actually working on a nonfiction book proposal. It's kind of what we're talking about. It's for writers, and it's to get them to understand the police culture, the character aspects of developing a police law enforcement character for mystery writers. There's a book out there that talks about procedures, and that's well and good. You can learn procedures, and I think it's a very good book. Lee Lofton put it out. I'd recommend it to all the writers. But what I'm going to try to do is something that comes alongside that but talks about the characters. And some of the things we're talking about as far as what happens to the psyche and the stages of police work that officers go through, the psychological stages, hypervigilance, the difference between a detective and a patrolman, the character, and, you know, what the years on the job, the impact it has, and those kind of things, and how to develop it in a writing sense. So I'm going to take a little step away from fiction right now, and I'm working on that. I'm actually working on a screenplay as well, so I've just been a busy little boy lately, I guess.
Excellent.
And that's why,
yeah,
I put on there, I can't figure out what I want to be when I grow up, because I'm not really sure, you know.
Well,
that keeps my life bouncing, you know.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's fun. So, Mark, what is your advice, I guess, for anyone listening that's an aspiring author? I know, you know, obviously the writing seminars and certainly developing,
yeah,
your skills, but what other advice do you have as far as writers? And maybe on the marketing side, because you do a lot of speaking. And I'll give you an example. Like, I once interviewed an author. She was a romance novelist, and she had several successful books, a phenomenal writer. But yet when I had her on the air to try to get her to speak about her book, it was like trying to pull teeth to get answers out of her. And I think it's so important that as writers, you're also able to speak to an audience,
yeah,
and really articulate your thoughts verbally. So can you speak to that a little bit? And did you ever struggle with that too?
No, I'm not cursed with that. I'm cursed with not being quiet. I've been very fortunate. I'm very extroverted. Again, I was class clown. I was always doing silly stuff. So getting up in front of people is a very comfortable environment for me, which is just, you know, that's just how I'm wired. Not everybody's wired that way. But in writing, just like anything else, you need to assess your weaknesses. You know, if you're a writer and, you know, you may be called on to speak and you're just not comfortable, well, there's classes out there that can help you. You know, there's things out there that can do it. Just like a writer, if you're maybe weak in your descriptions or your grammar's poor, well, then you need to correct it. You know, you can't just hope that, oh, okay, well, my story will be so great that it'll carry my poor grammar. Well, not really. No. You know, you have to work on you have to assess your weakness. And that's where I was at. My grammar was horrible. You know, and I looked at it, and again, it was from a poor education and learning disabilities or whatever. It doesn't really matter at that point. Once you're an adult, it is, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, I had to go and I had to do the hard work of taking grammar classes, working hard and learning and diagramming sentences, the things I should have done. When I was goofing off in class and throwing paper at people, I probably should have paid attention. So you have to assess your weaknesses as a writer, where you're at, what you need to work on to become a better writer. That's one piece of advice. But I'd also say read good books. Read them and digest them and ask yourself, why did this book really speak to me? Why did this novel? And I know I'm reading a good novel when I stop editing and I start just enjoying the story. You know, if I'm editing the book, I would have done it this way, or I would have done it that way, I'm not in the story. But it's when I lose myself and I'm just completely into the story, then I know I'm in a good book. And when you have that book, you ask yourself your questions as a writer. Why did I like this character so much? What about this character? What did the author do to make me like this character? So what did the author do to make this dialogue seem so sharp and real? You know, in these descriptions, what did the author, and if you start asking yourself those questions, write down notes or look at it, you'll start to be able to analyze other people's good writing, and it will naturally start to flow into your own writing. Because if you can analyze somebody else's like that, when you're looking at your own work and you're rewriting, you'll ask yourself the same questions. Okay, is this working for me or not? Why? And one of the hardest things to do as a writer is to self-analyze and to be able to take a step back from your work and look at it logically and say, is this working? Is this what I want my reader to understand or see from this page? Is this scene what I want my reader to get from this scene? And you have to, and it's hard to take a step back and look at it because it's all in our own head. We know our story. But to take an objective view and look at each thing that we're doing and ask ourselves the tough questions. And it takes practice and it takes work. Again, some people can come to the table maybe a little better equipped, but everybody can build that skill.
Sure. No, that is excellent advice. Yeah, excellent. And I mean, believe it or not, I mean, there was a time in my life when I struggled with public speaking. And, you know, it was funny. It was a boss.
I find that surprising.
Believe it, I kid you not, it's the absolute truth. But you know what happened? I did, one of my friends at the time, this was years ago, got me into Toastmasters, and that helped. But I'll tell you what really helped was when I had my first review, when I was working in marketing for a bank that is no longer in existence, but I was here in South Florida, and I had a great boss. And, you know, she said to me, she goes, you know, you're doing fabulous work, but she said, I noticed when you have to give a presentation to branch managers, you get really nervous. And she said, you know what, you have information that they need to do their jobs better. So there's really no reason to be nervous. And I don't know why that clicked with me, that little piece of advice. But it just seems from then on, I just kind of got over it.
Yeah. So. Well, I was very fortunate. What kind of helped me is court presentations. Because I go into court now, and then I realized also, similar to what you'd realized, I realized that, you know what, when I go to speak in a venue, they actually want to like me. But when I go into court, most people really don't want to like me. when a defense attorney's in there just ripping me over the coals, you know, just calling me names and all sorts of stuff. You know, when I go to another event and I'm actually speaking and stuff and they laugh at my silly jokes, it's like, this is a great place. I've been in a whole lot worse. So, speaking like anything else, even though I'm extroverted, it takes time, and it's something you kind of have to study as well. You don't want to come off like a buffoon or anything, you know, especially when you're presenting yourself as an author and as a professional. You do want to come off professional, so it's always good, like Toastmasters, and there's plenty of people who do the good training that's certainly good. It never hurts you. When I go to writers' conference, I always sit in on different classes as well, and some of them have been speaking classes, and there's always things available. So, yeah, I think that's good advice.
Yeah, definitely, because you really do want to – again, it goes back to that concept of people being as interested in you as the author as they are in your books, and you need to be able to relate to people and engage and be able to, you know, communicate back and forth with them and listening. Listening is the other aspect, too, I found, of presenting that's so important and just really being, you know, social and engaging with people, because I think, again, that they're interested in you as the writer, and a lot of times people are just so fascinated by the writing process itself and how it played out, because I find it's very unique for each individual writer. Your story is certainly unique from other authors that I've interviewed, so it's just very interesting how that plays out. Mark, and since, you know, this is WriteStream, but I know we interviewed you on a different show Saturday night on CRF Radio, and as we're getting towards, you know, we have about 10 more minutes, I did want to speak to kind of a real-world topic, because I part of what I'm trying to do here is also kind of expose a new audience to different viewpoints and to really understand what's actually going on in our country. We discussed the Second Amendment a lot on Saturday night, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that as a police officer, because you told us that you felt that a law-abiding citizen that owned, you know, that was able to carry and was registered to own a gun legally was actually an asset to your profession, and I was wondering if you could speak to that here as well.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity to do that. I am a big, big Second Amendment supporter for a number of reasons. And first of all, it helps law enforcement. It does not hinder it. You may hear other voices to the contrary and stuff, but I have to respectfully disagree with them. You know, Florida, we have over 1 million people with carry concealed permits. And I remember when that happened in 1987, they were talking about, oh, there's going to be blood in the streets. There's going to be like a shooting gallery and all. Well, those are people who don't understand human nature, who don't understand criminals, and who don't understand good citizens. Good citizens who have done the responsible training and gone through to carry concealed permit are an asset to law enforcement, because they can protect themselves and they can protect other people. A lot of this came about with the tragedy at Sandy Hook. But the reality is as that was going on, what those people did is they made phone calls. And there's very heroic people there who actually gave their lives to try to help these children. But in reality, they had no ability to defend themselves or anybody else. Okay, somebody with a firearm, with a carry concealed permit, with that kind of training, getting back to Sandy Hook, what they did is as soon as trouble started and those shootings started, they called other people with guns. So anybody can make that debate or try to make it. The reality is when something goes on, the first call that's made is to try to get police or somebody there with guns to stop this person. When you have a vibrant carry concealed permit, like in Florida, we have 1 million extra people who are good citizens who've already been vetted, who are out there who can potentially stop crime, and they can defend themselves. I'm working on a blog right now that's called When Seconds Count, which is kind of the joke, you know, when seconds count, the police are only minutes away. Well, that's so true. I cannot tell you. I mean, if one case in particular, you ask what cases stick out on your mind. This one's over 22 years old. I was in patrol. I got the call of a domestic, a lady screaming. I was at the very front of the apartment complex entrance when I got the call. I was able to turn my car right into, I mean, I was right there. Maybe took me a minute or two to get back to the back of the complex. And she was dying right there as I came up. She'd been stabbed to death.
Unable to defend herself
against a violent attacker. And I was as close as a cop could actually be without being on top of him. You know, and the guy had already run away. We ended up catching him. But, you know, those kind of things stick with you. And you think, you know, everybody said, you know, they'll bring up a tragedy and say, oh, look what they did with a firearm. Yeah, but look what happens to people who don't. Look what happens to women who aren't able to defend themselves against even an unarmed, you know, fully sized male. You can't, you know. So I see the tragedies on the other side. What if people have the ability to defend themselves, though, and stop evil from perpetrating evil acts on good people? So that's why, one of the reasons why I'm a big Second Amendment supporter of good citizens owning and having the ability to defend themselves and be an asset to law enforcement. And I think I had mentioned to you, I pulled up, that there's never been a situation where police officers ever had any issue with anybody with a carry concealed permit that ever tried to harm them. But yet there's multiple news accounts of people with carry concealed firearms coming to the rescue of officers in trouble. And that tells you everything you need to know. So that's my opinion on
that. Absolutely. And I think the fallacy is, too, I mean, people want to blame guns. And as you were saying, if you have a good citizen, it's the mindset of the person. I mean, in the case you just described, the woman was murdered with a knife. So are we going to outlaw knives now, too? I mean, it's insane. And I also think, and I want to get your opinion on this, Mark, I mean, these quote-unquote gun-free zones, I mean, anybody, I just don't understand the mindset of people that think that that's a good idea. I mean, basically, it announces to a criminal, hey, you got a bunch of sitting ducks here, so come on in and just start shooting and killing people.
Well, I think there's people, and some, however well-meaning, they're simply wrong. And as far as guns are bad, you know, you start talking to people, they shut their eyes. Oh, guns are bad. Guns, bad, bad, bad. That's all they can. They don't realize when you put up a sign that says gun-free, and the only people who are going to obey that are law-abiding citizens. The criminal will never obey it. They sit there and salivate. And this hasn't been proven for sure, but the Aurora, Colorado shooting, from his apartment, had to pass like five or six theaters to get to the theater that he went to do what he did that night. And that theater he went to was the only one that had a sign up saying no guns, no carry concealed allowed here. Now, you may believe in coincidence or not, but he had to pass like five or six other theaters, and some of them were larger, to get to that one. So I think it's not unreasonable to assume that that might have been a factor in him choosing that location to pull that off, because the good law-abiding citizens, which people, the overwhelming majority of people are, nobody wants to violate somebody's rules or laws. And unfortunately, you know, if there would have been somebody in there that could have at least defended or helped defend other people, we don't know how differently that could have turned out.
Yeah, I remember reading that as well. So, it's so true.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, Mark, we're down to, like, the last couple of minutes. I can't believe it. Time has really flown today. But let everybody know where they can find your blog and where they can find you on the Internet.
Okay, well, my personal blog is copwriter.com, all one word, copwriter, or markmanier.com, but nobody can spell my name, so copwriter will get you there. I also work with a self-defense group. It's called CompleteSelfDefenseGroup.com. And personalsafetyanddefense.com, which is a firearms portion of a complete self-defense. I work actually for a woman named Nanette Long, who teaches women self-defense and these kind of things. So if you're in the Central Florida area and interested, Nanette can certainly hook you up and get some good classes going. But anyway, my blog is, again, copwriter.com. Drop by and say hello. And it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed getting to know you a little bit better these last few interviews, and I hope we can do it again.
Thanks, Mark. No, I look forward to that, too. You'll have to let me know when your nonfiction book comes out, because I would love to bring you back on to discuss that. I think it would be a fascinating topic.
Oh, that would be a hoot. Yeah,
it would be fun. Sounds great. Well, thank you again for agreeing to join me for RightStream on such short notice. I really appreciate it, and we'll definitely be talking again soon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Again, I do appreciate you having me. I hope your listeners enjoyed it. And if you have any questions about what we talked about or whatever, my email is on the blog. Give me an email, and hopefully I can direct you in the right area. So.
Excellent. Sounds good. Take care, Mark, and have a great day.
All right, you too. All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was author Mark Minear, author and police officer and self-defense instructor. So check out his blog, copwriter.com. Thank you so much for joining me for this week's edition of RightStream Tuesday. I will be back here again next week at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please also check out the archives. Go to blogtalkradio.com/RightStream.